Friends, this summer, as we've preached our way through the surprises of Jesus, can there be anything more surprising than Jesus telling us to hate people? Surprise. And why not preach on it? Because it's summer. Usually, my hate shows up during the winter. And not only does he say that we need to hate people, he says that we need to hate people that are the closest to us. We need to hate those who are beloved family. So if it's uncomfortable for us to sit with this text, then that means that we probably need to sit with this text to see what God has to say for us, to us, see what deeper truth there is for us to hold on to. So we're going to talk about the stories that are around this text to try to get a better sense of what Jesus may be trying to say. So the story from today, Jesus is traveling with a group of folks. And while this group probably contained a mix of people, he seems to be speaking to the men, that group of men. No, actually not. That's what you get if you Google group of Jewish men walking together. And that's the Maccabees. They're a acapella singing group who have performed at the White House twice, and they want you to know that they never expected their professional life to turn out this way. All right, back to our story. We can assume that Jesus is talking to this group of men because in the passage that was read for this morning, he doesn't say, wives, hate your husbands. That's actually not anywhere in this. It is, husbands, hate your wives and your children. But not only that, but our story falls between two other stories that are about men dealing with family issues. The story of the great banquet and the story of the lost son. So here we have two stories that might give us some insight. So, in the story just before, the story of the great banquet, we're told about a certain man. A certain man is preparing a feast. A certain man, and we might imagine that this certain man has significant wealth. So much wealth that not only does he have all of his family living with him or attached to his property, but he probably has several slaves and servants who also are serving his property, and they all rely on him. And this certain man has invited many guests to a banquet, to a grand party, and of course the guests say yes, because that's what you do. Unlike today where everybody waits for the last minute to say yes, back then you got the yes early. So the evite went out, the responses rolled in, can't wait to see you guys, you throw the best parties, looking forward to it, I'll bring my guacamole. But on the day of the party, when the servants go out to get the people, their plans have changed. If their fear of missing out caused them to say yes, their fear of following through caused them to be no-shows. Have they colluded? How could they all have these excuses to not show up? And they seem like legitimate excuses, right? So one man has bought some property and he needs to go see it. Of course, that's what you do. One just bought a bunch of oxen and he's got to try them out. Of course you're going to try out your new oxen. One just got married and he must go to his honeymoon. Of course you're going to go to your honeymoon. Family commitments, all three of them. We've got family obligations, they say, can't make it. Family first, they say, can't make it. Land, possessions, and sex. Can't make it. The certain man gets mad. This good thing that he's prepared for them, they are going to miss out on. And it's really about them being able to enjoy it with him. And so he sends out his servants, and he says, you got to go further out. Go to the streets and to the lanes, bring in those who can't see, those who can't walk, those who are poor. You see, the party must go on. So the servants, being dutiful, they go out and they do what they're asked. The master sees that there's still room, and he sends the servants out even further. You need to go further out. You need to go to the boundaries. You need to go where there's dirt roads and where there's country lanes. You see, I want the house full. Those first invited will miss out. And Jesus tells another story. He tells a story about a father and two sons. And the younger brother, out of nowhere, says, "Dad, I want half of the family property. By rights, it's mine after you die. I want it now." He says the unthinkable. In no fewer words, he tells his dad that he wishes he were dead because he has his own plans. And so we might imagine that the father is heartbroken, bewildered. Maybe he was surprised, or maybe there was no surprise at all. Maybe this is who he's always known his son to be. We're not sure from the text. Either way, he does what the son asks, and he divides his property, and he gives half to the son. And then half remains for the rest of the household. And so the younger man, he took his money after he sold the land, the family land, the land that was intended to provide, and he sets off to a faraway country. And he spends it all. This thing that was supposed to sustain is now gone. Spent on wild living, we are told. That piques our interest. What a curious detail that begs us to judge this man. Well, that's what the men listening might have done. They might have been fuming. How irresponsible. What a fool. I would never do such a thing. And we come back to the younger son, and there he is. He's sitting in the dust. He's barely hanging on. There was so little that the farmers fed the pigs rather than him. The unclean animals had more than he did. And then Jesus tells us that this man, this younger son, began to think clearly. The servants have enough food in my father's house. Everyone is looked after in my father's house. There is enough in my father's house. And so he sets his face to home. And while still far away, his father sees him. And we're told that he hoists up his robes and he runs to greet his son in a very undignified fashion. And he reaches his son and he grabs him and he holds him and he kisses him exactly as a father would. The real treasure has returned. But the father's work isn't finished. The other son, the older son, has some words for his father. We might imagine that it wasn't just the two of them that heard these words, that others could have heard them, party guests perhaps. He's coming in from the fields. He smells the cooking meat. He hears the lively music. The servants tell him, "Your brother has returned, and there's a party." And he is angry, and he refuses to go in. So the father goes out to greet him. "How could you?" the son says. "How could you?" The hurt and the anger dripping off his words. "The dishonor that my brother has brought you. The dishonor that my brother has brought me and this family. How could you?" And here we have the oldest child playing his oldest child role from the family structures of the day. He was dutifully taking care of his parents, his property, the family business, while the younger child, the younger son, went off to play, following through on his role in the family structure of the day. My son, you are always with me, and everything that I have is yours. But we have to celebrate. Your brother, he was dead. Now he's alive. He was lost, and now he is found. The one who was declared dead is the one who is mourning the son he had lost and is now found. So let the party begin. So before we talk about the hate that's in both of these stories, we need to talk about hate in general. It's not a word that sits well with most of us. If anything, we try to stay away from it. We stay away from how, or we even try to deny that it's there. And we may even label it as wrong or sinful. Maybe we know what it's like to feel consumed by it, where it occupies our thoughts and our blood pressure rises and we lay in bed unable to sleep. And we can't get what so-and-so did to us out of our minds. And we churn and we boil and we smolder. Maybe this has been you. Maybe this has been someone close to you. The hate can burn white hot, It brings strong feelings, and it leaves little room for anything else. In the same way that its companion, romantic love, fills the room. Not that anybody in this room would know what that's about. This is the thing that movies are based on. This is running to a foreign land to meet the love of your life. Our judgment becomes impaired. We can't think clearly. We churn and smolder with strong feelings about the other. We lay in bed and our thoughts are full. We do things that we never thought we would do otherwise. You see, while being in love leads to assaults on our dignity, being in hate leads us to assaults on the dignity of others. But why? What could possibly be underneath such strong feelings? Both romantic love and hate have at their root our deep fear of being put aside, rejected, or abandoned. Hate may in fact be about fear, the fear of not having a place with those, by being left by those that we rely on for our security, for our feelings of safety, for the closeness of people to take care of us. And we may even use romantic love or hate to banish the fear that's at the root of our own powerlessness. We're powerless about the future. We're powerless about the past. We're powerless about whether tomorrow we're powerless about whether tomorrow we'll find ourselves alone. And while love uses the fantasy of coming together with a loved one to banish those fears, hate holds the promise that if we destroy, that if we banish, that if we degrade, if we make unhuman the hated thing that is causing our fear, then I'll feel less afraid, then I'll feel more safe, more powerful, and less powerless. So I have two options. I can deny that I'm powerless, or I can act out in hate to destroy that thing that I think threatens me, to destroy that thing that the cocoon of safety I've built for myself. So, back to our story. We can assume that Jesus is talking to a primarily middle generation group of men, men with freedom, men with land, men with responsibilities, men with people who rely on them. And like the certain man who threw a party and the father of the two sons, we can assume that these men, their place in the community, affected the well-being of other people, that others relied on them and didn't have a choice to rely on them. So it wasn't just the parents and spouses who relied on them. It was the siblings, the servants, the slaves, those who worked in the community, that lived on the outskirts of town, that didn't live in gentrified neighborhoods. And these men have set off to wander about with Jesus. Maybe they're caught up in the spectacle of who Jesus is or the cool things that he's been doing, or maybe their hearts are stirred. And yet, they still have generations above and below who depend on them. These men are the men from the first part of the first story, those who accepted the invitation to the party but couldn't show up. These well-meaning men didn't want to upset the apple cart at home, and so they missed out on the banquet. In the other story, though, maybe these men are like the young son who speaks the unspeakable, "I hate you, Dad." This utterance sends him on a journey that led him to a place where he had to sit in the pain of the fear of having no place at all. The farmers fed the pigs instead of him. It was from this place, a place that started with hate, that he got his wits about him, and he turned to head home. He took up his cross, and he walked. So, Jesus isn't asking the traveling men to leave their families to follow him. No, he's actually doing something that I think is much more difficult. Instead, he's asking them to hate their family. Because of the position that they've been born into, they have responsibility for their well-beings. The well-beings and their decisions affect other people. And these men didn't ask for it. And they may even have grown callous to that it's happening. And they maybe barely even register the upset that has been built up by living in the expectation of what they're supposed to do. They also may have built some self-esteem about built some self-esteem based on their role, on their social importance. Others depend on me. I must matter. My mattering comes from other people depending on me. And they hear it from mom, and they heard it from dad, and they heard it from grandparents and people at the market. They've been playing their part for so long, I wondered if they're aware that they're even playing it anymore. What would they be without their role? Maybe Jesus is the excuse that they need to just walk away and to leave it all behind. But instead, Jesus wants to save these men, but not in the way that they might expect, and not at the expense of the lives of vulnerable people. He wants to save them where they are most vulnerable, that place where they can't provide it all, where they need to receive. Their privileged family life may have insulated them and cut off the circulation to their very own hearts. And Jesus is telling these men that to know the work of God in their lives, they have to let go. They have to let go of the fantasy that protecting and providing for their family and their property and their own self-interest at the expense of others may cost not only their lives, but may cost the lives of others too. The stranger, the widow, the orphan, the Muslim man crossing the Mediterranean, the Central American woman and her children under the threat of gang violence waiting at the border. That is too high a cost for spiritual blindness. At this moment, while we sit here, there is a ship in the Mediterranean Sea named the Aquarius. Maybe you've heard of this ship. This ship rescues men, women, and children who are fleeing violence in their home countries, countries like Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, Iran. The son of COS members is actually a doctor on this boat right now. And this boat collects people who have set out for the hospitality of other nations, but are often stopped from entering other countries. People caravan thousands of miles to arrive at the sea to make the very dangerous crossing to Greece, to the promise of some safety. And so these people, they bob and they float, 200 men, women, and children in a boat built for 20. And the diesel fuel mixed with seawater burns their skin and they wait. And if they are rescued by the Aquarius, they are treated and fed and wait again until an EU country will take them in. Many drown on this journey. Many drowned. And on the southern border of the United States, thousands of children await being reunited with their families. We know the stories of how these children and parents are being separated. You've probably seen this picture before. Some in this room may even know the terror of being separated from families or being held in a camp while a government decides your fate. We've learned that enforcement of immigration laws doesn't have to be done this way. Such policies are born of a fear that there will not be enough for my family, that there may not be enough for then an immigrant family, or for a poor family, or for somebody who is blind or cannot walk. For many, the acts of keeping a boat of people in need offshore or separating children from parents at the U.S. border, these things are seen as filled with hate. Indeed, there is hate here, but it's not what Jesus was suggesting. While personal hate is red hot, institutional hate is cold, it's calculating. It almost seems rational, and it's done for the good of the country, and cares little for the voices of those affected. A secret enemy, if we let them in, will kill us. We'll be in danger because of them. Instead, what makes us vulnerable is out there. And we need guns, and we need walls, and we need tanks, and we need officers to protect us. Jesus said instead, hate your own family. Hate the way that you turn to them. Hate the way that you use them. Hate the way that you use them to avoid your deep vulnerability without even realizing it. It may even look like love. The humming along of family life can be so strong that we may not even notice that we've built an entire empire around not having to feel the pain of our own frailty and need for God and for other people. Yet this is the place that God works. God works in the deepest, most tender parts of who we are. I am the one who can give you rest, God says. Turn to me, I won't reject you, God says. You need not worry about how it will be for you and your family should you welcome those in need, God says. Take up your cross and follow me, God says. Jesus knows the cost of what he is saying. And we celebrate it week after week, right here, around the table. We celebrate Jesus letting go. When Jesus invites these men to hate their families, he's inviting them to turn from host to guest, from one who provides to one that receives, because he knows that their hearts need it. In the routines of day-to-day life, their hearts have turned to stone, and he wants to give them soft, fleshy hearts, hearts that in their moments of fear are open to the love of Jesus. So, what's here for those of us in the room who are not middle-generation men, tending to older and younger people in our lives? Although I see some of us out there. The reality is that we are all part of families. Some of these families are biological. Some are adoptive. Some are foster. Some are church families. Some are work families. But we're all part of families. For some of us, the reminder is that you are kept, that you are held, and that you are not abandoned by God, even if your family has not done right by you. Just as God was watching out for the women and the children and the servants in the households of these men, God is watching out for you. God is watching out for you. With Jesus, there is enough for you. For some, the invitation is to rest in God's love. You've given up so much. To sit here this morning has cost you so much. You've had no choice in the matter of having to ask for help or receiving help. You've gone from being an engineer to operating a press in a factory, from tending to family needs in a village to cleaning sheets in a nursing home. God sees you. God knows the difficulty of what you've had to do. And for others of us, the invitation is to look at our own family life. What brings life in our family? And what decisions and actions are we making that are rooted in our own fear? For some, the invitation is to remember that vulnerable people depend on our hospitality and that there will be enough in God's community. Feelings of hate are difficult to deal with. And one of the ways that we tend to hate is by facing the fear and the powerlessness that live behind it. Little by little, to face those things with someone or with someone's with whom we feel safe and can feel those feelings. Someone who is reliable, who is not afraid of us or our feelings. The younger son's actions had consequences. There was less land. There was less money after he left, and the household had to adjust. But we're told that there was enough and that there was a party, because one who was dead was alive and one who was lost was found. And the father hiked up his robes and he ran out to greet him, her, you, and me. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.